I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. What is happiness, and what does empirical research and psychological sciences say about how we can be happy? What's the relationship of personal character to happiness? And can drugs help? We'll be asking those questions of Jonathan Haidt today, the author of The Happiness Hypothesis. Stay tuned. I'm speaking today with Jonathan Haidt. John Haidt is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. His research examines the emotional basis of morality and the ways that morality varies across cultures. He's the author of the very interesting book, The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Truth in Ancient Wisdom, which has a great website at happinesshypothesis.com. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jay. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the positive psychology movement, which I haven't talked about before on my show, and which I'm just devouring now that I have discovered it. I'm devouring everything that I can about it. What are the origins of this idea of positive psychology, and where is it now as a movement?
Right. Well, the idea that psychology can be used to help people get more out of life is a very old idea, and it's come and gone two previous times in history, once in the 1890s in the healthy-mindedness movement, and William James was involved in that a bit. Then it came back as humanistic psychology, when people said, hey, why is psychology all about running rats and mazes? What about self-actualization? And then it went away again, then it came back in the late 1990s when Martin Seligman, who was president of the American Psychological Association, said, hey, wait a second, we're getting all this funding from the government to study mental illness, and we're all focused on racism and aggression and drug addiction. Why isn't anybody studying things that would actually help most people? Because most people aren't sick. Most people are doing reasonably well but want to know how to get more out of work or love or family. And so when they go to the psychology section of the bookstore, they find Dr. Phil and Deepak Chopra. Positive psychology is a movement within normal, regular scientific psychology to kind of balance our portfolio and start studying the positive side of life, strengths and virtues.
Talk a little bit about virtues, because I think for most people, the notion of virtue is a very religious idea, a very moralistic idea. How is positive psychology attempting to empirically ground and categorize the virtues?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a shame that religion seems in many people's minds to have co-opted the whole language of morality. We can't live without morality any more than fish can live without water, but those of us who are secular then find ourselves with an impoverished vocabulary. So I'm quite pleased that positive psychology is taking back the language of virtues and just taking it as a straight empirical project. That is, what are the character strengths, what are the abilities and positive traits that have been valued around the world and across the ages? And it might have been that list was highly variable, and it's somewhat variable, but Seligman and Chris Peterson did a review in which they found that there are six overarching virtues, things like courage, justice, wisdom. And then they developed a taxonomy of 24 more specific strengths under those six virtues. They created a kind of a handbook. In psychology, we have the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is an exhaustive catalog of everything that can go wrong with you. And this new catalog is kind of the anti-DSM. It's kind of a catalog of 24 things that can go right with you. And I hope this will be quite relevant to, I know, what we're going to be talking about in terms of self-enhancement. So that's the origin. And this framework has guided so much research in positive psychology. Perhaps the central idea in positive psychology nowadays is know your strengths and then arrange your life, especially your work, but arrange your life so that you get to draw on your strengths and you can completely avoid your weaknesses. We're often told to work on what we're bad at, but the message from positive psychology is that's to some extent futile. Rather, try to run around your backhand. Try to team up with people. Try to do whatever you can so that you get to use your strengths, not your weaknesses.
Well, that's, in fact, what I want to end up with this interview is about the notion of strengths and weaknesses, because some of the innateness of our strengths and weaknesses may be malleable and variable in the future. But let's start with the with that basic model of innateness and then what we can work on. And mm-hmm. could you talk for a second, your book, The Happiness Hypothesis, it's a fascinating way to approach the subject, but what you've done, unlike the Seligman virtue categorization, you went around and collected hypotheses that were present in various parables or nostrums or sayings of various religious and spiritual traditions, and you put them into different pots that where they were similar, and you came up with 10 basic hypotheses. One of which is that it's all in your mind. Another that it comes through virtue, that happiness, that is, and that it's your friends and things like that. And you bring it around to this central positive psychology notion of the formula of H equals S plus C plus V. So could you elaborate on that formula for a second?
Sure. If the question is, what makes us happy? Why are some people happier than others? What factors, what ingredients go into making us happy? And most people assume it's things like health and wealth and family. And it turns out wealth isn't all that important. Even health isn't all that important because people adapt to steady states, so no matter what happens. Family absolutely is important. That's one of the few that really does stand up. But much more systematically, a few researchers, Sonia Lubomirsky and Ken Sheldon, David Shkade did was they reviewed a lot of literature on what factors actually matter and which factors don't. And they came up with this lovely little formula, which, as you said, is H equals S plus C plus V. H is the amount of happiness you're experiencing in any given time, let's say on any given day. Well, as we know from twin studies in the 90s, we all have a biological set point for happiness. Happiness is perhaps the most heritable trait we know of. If you look at identical twins and who are separated at birth, raised in different families, they tend to be similar on just about everything, whether they like jazz, whether they like broccoli, and whether they're happy. Twins are similar on just about everything because our genes contribute to just about everything about us. Happiness and IQ are two of the most heritable traits known. Those are up around 0.7.
Just if I could interrupt for a second, this idea, of course, is, as you point out, is present in many different cultures and diagnostic systems, and I'm familiar with the Buddhist one, mm-hmm. where there's there's different meditations to be prescribed for someone who has a basically dyspeptic character, or someone who has a more sanguine character, or someone who has a more lustful character, and similarly with the idea of the humors in Western medicine. So this notion that we have a basic innate preset character that we have to work with is a very common one.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and it's something which has occurred to an awful lot of parents. My mother says that my sisters and I had the personality we have as adults from about the first week or two of life, and a lot of parents have a similar experience. So the idea of innate temperament is an old one. It's kind of funny to my mind. I'm so interested in politics and morality. It's, even though I'm a political liberal myself, it's just funny to watch political liberals squirm because they're so uncomfortable with ideas of innateness. They want to believe that everything is malleable, everything can be changed by
even some political attitudes are apparently politically inherited or genetically inherited.
That's right. That's right. Whether you're liberal or conservative is to some extent heritable. You would be similar to your identical twins on average. This is the heavy innate part is to say that there really is a set point. And this set point, which is really just a function of the balance between your approach and avoidance systems in your brain, approach circuits are located in part on the left frontal cortex and avoidance fear withdrawal circuits on the front right. And we all have a balance between those two sets of systems. And those who are set more towards approach, those people go through life happy, curious. They approach new things rather than fearing the worst about them. So this is all very biologically based, and for a while in the 1990s, some of the leading researchers said, you can't make yourself any happier, just as you can't make yourself any taller. All right, well, that takes us up to the beginning of positive psychology in the late 90s, when Seligman and others started saying, even if there's a set point, there are still things you can do. I mean, our happiness does fluctuate throughout our lives. I mean, it has some relationship to what goes on in life. So what are those other factors? And that's what these C and V are. So happiness is a function of your set point plus certain conditions of your life, that's C, plus certain voluntary activities, certain things that you can do. C, it turns out, has only very little to do with wealth. It has much more to do with the amount of control you have over your life and the degree of relatedness. If you are enmeshed in many close relationships, that's probably the most important part of it. The rich are only very slightly happier than the middle class. Although, of course, if you're poor, it turns out if you're in the very bottom of the income distribution, then an additional few thousand dollars actually will impact your happiness.
Which has been enlisted by utilitarian policy analysts as a strong redistributive argument.
Mm-hmm.
Taking $1,000 away from a rich person and giving it to someone who's poor increases the net happiness in society.
That's right. Oh, I think the tax policies in the United States since the Bush administration have been just disastrous. I mean, the extra $5 million in avoided inheritance taxes isn't going to impact anybody's happiness, but boy, does it affect what the government can do in terms of solving social problems and helping poor people. So the last element in the formula, V, this is the area that I think really is new in positive psychology, is to just kind of systematize this, that it's not just a matter of getting the conditions in your life right. There are certain habitual practices, and the two best known, the two best studied are meditation, which is certainly the oldest one, and cognitive therapy. Both of them really get control of your wild, crazy mind, the mind that Buddhists say is like a jumping monkey that's so hard to control, and that tends to dwell on the negative. So meditation and cognitive therapy are both very effective means of getting control. Now, there's a third way, it's not exactly a voluntary activity. It is taking Prozac. It is taking an SSRI. And that is the only known way of changing your set point. Well, I should qualify that. A lifetime of meditation, there's some hints that people who meditate for 20 years actually do reset their brains. And there might be some sort of brain surgery. Maybe you could, have certain fear circuits destroyed in your brain. That also would change your set point, but I'm not exactly going to advise that. So that's the happiness formula, H equals S plus C plus V.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Haidt. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, and he is the author of the book Happiness Hypothesis. This is Dr. J, and you're listening to Change Surfer Radio. People will, of course, wonder how you're measuring happiness, because if any of us are at all introspective, we know that our happiness jumps around from moment to moment, day to day, and we may be happy about one thing but not another. So could you talk for a second about the kinds of measures and the different kinds of happinesses that we're trying to measure here?
Yeah. There are many differences cross-culturally in the definitions of happiness. I think for Americans, there's a pretty good consensus that happiness is some sort of internal state. It's a kind of feeling. And that if you feel happy, then you are, and if you don't feel happy, then you're not. Somebody can't tell you that you're happy, and you say, no, I'm not. Now, for many people, and certainly the Greeks, their word was eudaimonia, which was sometimes translated as happiness, but really means more like well-being. That's more the state of a life well-lived. You can't really know whether a man lived well until he is dead, the Greeks thought, and you look at the whole life. I think both of these notions are really useful. My own view is that happiness is the feeling we get when our life is going well, when our life is being lived well, and when that feeling is justified. Of course, through drugs and other things, we can change our mood temporarily. But there's a certain kind of depth and richness when we feel that we're making progress towards our goals, when we feel that we're heading in the right direction in the company of people that we love and trust. So I kind of want to draw from both of those traditions, the idea that happiness is just a good feeling inside, and the idea that happiness is a life well lived.
Now, part of the quandary here is the trade-off between pleasures and gratification, and I found the discussion of the psychological literature on this in your work very fascinating, because on the one hand, you can increase your overall level of subjective well-being by having lots of little pleasures, ice cream and sex and and the other kinds of pleasures in your life. But then you run into the problem of the hedonic treadmill.
That's
that
right.
You get used to those things, and then they don't give you the bang for the buck anymore. And you contrast those with gratifications. So could you talk about what kinds of things have these more lasting, hedonic treadmill-resistant kinds of effects on subjective well-being?
Sure. To go back to that central idea of positive psychology, that you need to know your strengths and then use them, gratifications are activities that give us pleasure, but that do so by drawing on our strengths. So, for example, for me, one of my strengths, and this is true for most professors, I hope, is love of learning, and another is curiosity. There's a whole bunch related in that area of the taxonomy that are related to knowledge and wisdom. And for me, doing research on a topic, learning new things, this just gives me a thrill. Now, leadership and social intelligence are not two of my great strengths. I can do them. I can run things. But I feel drained when I do it. I don't really enjoy it. So that's the difference. Leading, organizing, correcting people, this is draining to me. It's not gratifying. Whereas doing the research for the book, I had a sabbatical a year ago in the spring, and I was able to just work on this book all day long. I just was able to shut my door and read and think and work things out, and that to me was heaven. It's very gratifying. I love ice cream, and I enjoy eating ice cream for that 5 minutes more than I enjoy working on the book, but you can't eat ice cream 24 hours a day.
It seems a little counterintuitive to me that the recommendation here is that if you recognize that you're not good at something like leadership and you are good at something like scholarship, that you should focus on doing more of the scholarship, because wouldn't you have a more lasting sense of accomplishment and self-improvement and broadening of your personality if you worked on the things that you're weak in?
No, because it's very difficult to change your basic traits. And so, of course, there are technological ways of doing so, but it's very difficult to change your basic traits and your strengths. So my handwriting is terrible. I've worked on it for years, and I used to, at least when I was a kid. Never got anywhere. It was just frustrating. The idea here isn't to change your basic strengths, it's to employ them. So in life, you don't have to do everything well. You can get married, and suddenly you have somebody who has all these other skills. My wife is great at gratitude. She loves writing beautiful cards and thoughtful notes. I'm terrible at it. So I don't have to work on it anymore. I got married. You can't do everything well. There's just too much going on in life.
Okay, well, that brings us to this topic of technological modification of character, because one of the things that I'm very interested in is the way that stimulant medication for ADHD or SSRIs for depressive symptoms or testosterone suppression for people who have obsessive sexual thoughts, men who have obsessive sexual thoughts, how these are ways that we actually are learning to control the structure of the brain and these innate drives and characteristics in ways which may, in fact, portend future technological fixes for our character flaws.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think so. I think the implications here are quite profound. Let me just make two points up front that might help to frame the discussion. What I've found, because I've been interested in, I study taboo violations. I study all those sorts of things that people think are wrong, but they can't point to a victim. So my dissertation was on stories like, a family whose dog was killed in front of their house by a car, and they heard the dog meat was delicious, so they cut it up and ate the body. And most people think, oh, well, this is terrible. And you say, why? Well, it's just disgusting. Or you shouldn't eat a family member or something. They'll say all sorts of things, but there's not a victim. The dog was already dead. I've also experimented over the years with stories about Prozac and brain surgery and diet pills and all sorts of things and body modification that people think, Americans at least, get creeped out by, and they think are wrong, but they have trouble explaining why. One thing that I found is that when you put it in any sort of a medical model, when you say to Americans, this person suffers from depression or from a biological disorder that makes him or her overeat, people are quite happy to say, okay, fine, if it's a medical problem, if it's a deficiency that you need to correct, that's okay. But when it comes to enhancement, then people get very uncomfortable, and there's several different reasons for that. One is this interesting intuition, which is, we find it in Shakespeare's Hamlet, this above all to thine own self be true. Say that to any American, and they will nod and say, oh, yes, of course. Oh, that is one of the best pieces of wisdom ever.
The authenticity, the doctrine of authenticity.
That's right, the authenticity. And I used to sort of play devil's advocate with that, say, oh, really? Why should you be true to yourself? What if yourself is bad? What if yourself is stupid or lazy? Why should you be true to yourself? Why shouldn't you improve yourself no matter what? So I used to play devil's advocate, and I used to have a very kind of practical, harm-based morality. But here's the other point. Maybe this is the main thing that I could contribute to this debate that you may not find elsewhere, is that when you approach these questions from a purely material point of view, from a purely utilitarian point of view, then the sky's the limit. There is no reason not to do any of these things. Look, Ritalin will make us all smarter. It doesn't just work for ADHD. Ritalin makes everybody able to focus better. Prozac will not do much for very happy people, but boy, it would help a lot of people who are in the middle or just below the middle of the distribution.
Dysthymia.
So why not? Excuse me?
Dysthymia.
Yeah, that's right. So from a purely utilitarian point of view, all of these technologies should be greatly, greatly spread. And in my opinion, Prozac is vastly underprescribed. Now, that's just from a purely utilitarian point of view. Here's the other point of view. And this is something that it took me a long time to to come to, because you know I'm a Jewish atheist and a professor and all those sorts of things that you know, your listeners can kind of stereotype and guess my political views. But in doing the research for this book and in studying purity and pollution practices in India and across cultures, I've come to realize that most people on this planet have in them ideas about sacredness, about divinity, about our higher and lower nature. It's not just a matter of hurting and helping people. It's also a matter of living in a noble way, an uplifting way. And part of that is having limits and respecting limits. And when you act as though all that matters is people's sense of gratification, you're somehow cheapening life.
But see, that's where I think your positive psychology focus adds a really interesting twist to this. And where I have been an advocate of the right to human enhancement technologies for a long time, it's been on a purely liberal grounds that people should be able to do whatever they want with their bodies and brains. And that leads people to be very uncomfortable because they say, well, what if somebody just wants to lie in the gutter and have a pleasure jack stuck in their head all the time? And I think where the interesting question comes in here is, well, what if we're not talking about just a liberal advocacy of these technologies? What if we're talking about actually using them in ways which are consistent with and looking for the ways in which they are consistent with the improvement of character? So, for instance, with SSRIs, it's very difficult to carry out your moral obligations to others when you're systematically depressed because you just don't have any energy.
That's right.
And what you find in your own literature is that it's, in fact, happy people who have more friends and who do more volunteering and all kinds of things. There's a feedback loop between having the energy from not being depressed to do all the right things in your life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that's right. And I think that's a good way to put it, that SSRIs have so much more, how should we say, sort of bang for the buck or downstream positive unanticipated consequences. When people are depressed, they are sort of miserable and self-focused and often not very giving, and happy people end up being much more giving and productive. So if you can fix people's depression, even if it's just mild, you do get a payoff in terms of other character traits, which is good for society. And boy, certainly I've seen it save marriages among friends and family. So, again, I am very bullish on SSRIs. Now, I do have to say, because every time I speak about this, I get some angry calls, it's really important to note that SSRIs do have some side effects, especially sexual side effects. There is an association with suicide, although it's complicated, because overall, they greatly lower the suicide rate. They actually are responsible for many more people being here than otherwise would. But some people end up killing themselves who otherwise would not have. So you are playing a bit of Russian roulette.
Because they were so depressed that they couldn't even consider killing themselves.
For the most part, that's right. That appears to be what a lot of it is that when people are very depressed, they actually don't kill themselves because they can't mobilize. But it's not just the very depressed people. There have been suicides of people who weren't very depressed. So the evidence is still out on that. But I just want to say it's powerful stuff, and it is slightly dangerous stuff. I believe that overall the social payoffs are vastly outweigh the costs. So I just do have to say that. But let me just go back to what you said about how you think that people should be able to do what they want. That is the crux of the issue. If you're a liberal, you believe that. I was profoundly affected by reading Emile Durkheim in graduate school, and I know you went to the University of Chicago, and as I understand it, Durkheim just sort of hovers over the campus there as a god.
Well, Adam Smith on the other half of the campus.
Sorry, over the economics department, yeah. Well, Durkheim, in his book Suicide, he examined social science evidence from the 19th century, and he concluded that the more free you are, the more likely you are to kill yourself. The more you are tied down into family and obligations and restrictions and limitations, the better off you are. Now, there's a limit on that. Obviously, you're chained to a wall. That's terrible. But there's a paradox in modern life in that we get increasingly free to pursue whatever we want, and the freer we are to do so, the harder it is to be happy. We need limits and constraints to be happy. And this is, I think, the danger of all of these self-enhancing technologies. Even though in each individual case you can point to the benefits, and the benefits usually outweigh the harms, taken as a whole, many people, and particularly conservatives, are fearful of going down that road, because once you go down that road, there are no more limits. Man plays God. Man becomes God. And when there are no limits, it's awfully hard to find happiness.
Okay. Well, you know, when I debate this with people, I give the example of diabetes management. It's possible, if you're a diabetic, to completely manage your diabetes with diet. And I think that that's great if people can do it. But there are other people who need insulin to do it.
Oh, right. Again, when you put it in a medical model, there's no debate. Everyone agrees.
Okay, but this is precise. If we have diagnoses of people's brain types, which say you're a brain type where you are chronically dysthymic, you're at the 30th percentile of happiness, and as a consequence, you don't have as much energy or attention for other people's or for your family members or for your church. And therefore, if we could get you up to the 70th percentile or the 80th percentile of happiness, or have the consistently have the happiness of the Dalai Lama, you might be able to do as much for the world as the Dalai Lama. Now, that's an enhancement argument. That's saying, why can't we move everybody up to the 90th percentile?
And on that one, I would go with you. I agree, and I think it should be done. As I said, I'm very bullish about SSRIs, and I think that they should be taken more widely.
But then, why doesn't it apply to courage and patience?
Okay.
And
well, let's start with intelligence. What if there was a minor brain operation that could make you much smarter? What do you think? Should it be free to, or you know, people could pay for it, but should it be available to anyone who wants it?
Well, that's easy. I think the greater intelligence is an intrinsic benefit for each individual, and it's a benefit for society as a whole for everybody to be smarter. We do. What policy regime would you like to live under? One that said everybody should be smarter, or one that said no one should be smarter?
Oh well, no, you certainly don't want to you know, make people either be dumb or. But I guess it. Now I feel like I'm a subject of one of my own experiments. Again, I'm a liberal secular atheist. I personally would not mind if this operation or drug was made widely available. But I'm just getting more sensitive to the downstream, the unanticipated effects. And this is actually what conservatives are truly wise about. Much of, at least classical conservatives, forget religious right, forget George Bush, he's not a true conservative. But true conservatives are those who think that social systems are complicated and we can't just rush in and manipulate them. There are often unanticipated consequences. So if we did make intelligence-enhancing drugs or surgery widely available, well, we would then have an underclass of those who didn't have the surgery who would basically just be the menials who would do our laundry for us. It's just, I don't know, maybe that's not any worse than what we have now. Maybe that is actually what we have now. My gosh, it is what we have now. I don't know. This is hard.
Well, John, I really appreciate your coming on. And are you working on something else? Your first book is such a wonderful blockbuster success. I assume you've got another contract in the making.
Well, in terms of a book for a wide audience, I put just about every idea I've ever had is contained in The Happiness Hypothesis. So I don't have another book waiting to go. I will be writing a book next spring on moral psychology, kind of a monograph for Oxford, just bringing together in a coherent one place a story about how our moral mind works. So that'll be my next book next year. I'll be spending a year at Princeton as a visiting professor.
Excellent. I've been speaking with Jonathan Haidt. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. He's one of the leading lights of the positive psychology movement. He is the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, which can be found with many links at happinesshypothesis.com. And I want to thank you again for coming on.
My pleasure, Jade. This was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.